Wow.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is All About Wine, the talk show dedicated to the wine industry since 2009. Featuring winemaker, cellar master, vineyardist, and tasting expert, Ron.
Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is just trying to educate people and trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly.
From coast to coast and around the world.
You know, we really have had some neat people on the program. I love that.
Post your questions and comments during the live show on our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. Again, that's www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. And now, All About Wine is on. Here's Ron.
All right, bus people.
Welcome to the show.
There you go.
There it is.
Right.
Hang on, and we are official.
There we go. All right. They finally shut up again for us. We have a guest tonight, Nathan Carlson. He's the winemaker and general manager of Center of Effort Winery in California, in the Edna Valley in California. So he will be joining us shortly. But before he gets here, we'll always give you the good things. 7:01 p.m. Thursday, October 22nd, 2020. So if you're going to contact us, do it now. If not, we're going to be in archives. But a couple of quick announcements from the past shows and the people who've been on the past shows. Last week we had Michael. Jeez, I don't think his name. No.
Jim Loughran.
Jim. Oh, Jim, yeah, Jim. Yeah. Jeez, I had a blank on his name. Last week we had Jim on the program, and Jim has been promoting us big time. He's put us on his site. He's been telling people about us. He's been doing all sorts of stuff and letting people know about All About Wine and everything. So thank you, Jim. If you happen to be listening to this show, we do appreciate the shout outs and all that stuff there. That was very nice of you. He's put a lot of stuff up, you know, 6 or 7 different posts.
Our guest tonight did the same thing. He, maybe 30 minutes, an hour ago, posted, and he's looking forward to it. So, thank you for that. And for making our post for tonight too. Thank you.
I didn't see that one yet. Yeah. I saw Jim pop up a couple of times there, and then, we've got some other guests coming up in November. I have been talking to some people over the last few days, actually. And we have November 15th guest, and I think it's 15th. I don't have my calendar in front of me. Where's my calendar? There it is. We have a guest coming up on November 12th. And one on the 19th. So we have a couple guests coming up in November already. And one of them is a podcaster. And one of them used to work as a circus performer before he got into winemaking. So we've got some good stories coming up in November there. And next week, we are doing our Halloween show. We have missed that in the last couple of years, but we used to do Halloween shows and Halloween months all the time in October, and we got away from it for some reason. But we are scheduled a Halloween show next week. Joy Neighbors will be joining us again. She's been a guest in the past during our haunted month, and she'll be joining us again. So tune in next week for your Halloween show. Looks like we might have Nathan sitting there waiting for us. Let me go get him. Hello, Nathan. Welcome to the show.
Hey there. Really nice to be with you guys. How are you?
Hey. I'm doing great. How about yourself?
Yeah, we're a little tired and sticky from harvest out here, but we're doing well.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you you are finished with harvest now, huh? You're not at the end?
Well, we have a little bit of Grenache still on the estate that will probably come in late next week. We're going to pick about 3 tons of it tomorrow and then the balance of the block later in the week. And then we do some winemaking for clients as well, and we have a bit of fruit for them as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was noticed that you do take care of other people besides yourself, so that has to keep you busy just doing that. So that's
yeah, it does. And we'll probably be busy up until about Thanksgiving just with the press-offs and all the work that kind of follows up after harvest.
Yeah, it gets quite hectic, I know. You know, it's talk to people, and it's always nice to get someone on during harvest because it can be a very numbing time for you out there. I understand that. A lot of questions for you. You're from a winery called Center of Effort. I'm going to let you explain to start with where that name came about.
Yeah, absolutely. So Center of Effort, we're a all estate winery on the central coast of California within the Edna Valley Appalachian. It's a very cool coastal region where we focus on Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. Center of Effort, the name itself was chosen by the owners, and it Center of Effort is a term in sailboat racing. It's a point within the sails where the forces of the wind come together and move the boat through the water. The analogy for winemaking is it takes a lot of different disciplines to line up in the right direction to make a wine successful. So that's where that came from.
Oh, it just when I first saw it, Center of Effort, I'm going, Center of Effort, you know, not being a selling person myself, it caught me off guard. So it makes sense. Yes, it's that's a good name. You mentioned the owners. Give us the history. How did Center of Effort get started? Who the owners? Why there? Did they own land? Did they fly out to California and say, I want a winery there? What happened?
Well, so Bill and Cheryl Swanson own the winery, and they have since 2008. They both grew up here on the Central Coast within they were high school sweethearts at Morro Bay High School, and Bill went to Cal Poly and studied engineering there on a golf scholarship. He went on to work for Raytheon, and he retired from Raytheon about five years ago as the CEO and president of the company.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so he still had a few years at Raytheon when I came on board to manage the wine project here. His grandfather had farmed grapes in the Central Valley, and he, you know, had come to know wine and love wine and really wanted to have a wine project here in this area that's really special to them. And in fact, the winery itself is it's an older winery. It was established as the Lawrence Winery in 1978. So it's one of the older production facilities here in the Valley. And it was one of the first places that they went wine tasting together. So even a lot of people come through here, and when we tour them through the cellar, you can see the tile work on the floor where the old tasting room used to be. And so it's nostalgic for a lot of people, and a lot of great winemakers have passed through here over time. So there's a lot of kind of a touchstone for our area.
I one thing that you said there that caught my ear, you said his grandfather did winemaking in Central Valley. That is so different from this area. It just seems like night and day, the Central Valley being so hot and, you know, all the Central Valley stuff and then getting on the coast like this, it's such a difference.
Yeah, I think that it was more it's the draw of the agriculture. And I know Bill has talked about good memories that he has of his grandfather kind of gathering everyone, the whole family together. And you know, that he made his own wine. Primarily, I believe it was a table grape vineyard, but he would make his own wine. And in fact, I have in my office the name of his, when he packed his table grapes, it was called Full Sail. And in fact, that's the name of one of the business entities that we have. And I have one of his old packing labels as a framed up piece in my office as well. So it's definitely that agriculture runs really deep in in the ownership.
It sounds like it does, yes. Just I looked through the website and all that. There's this couple of neat pictures there. The one of the pictures has the big tanks and all the buildings. Is that where you do everybody else's work, and then you all do yours closer to the tasting room? Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean,
I say everybody else is all the other.
Yeah, I would say that we're about 5 to 10% of the total production of the winery in a given year, and a lot of the. Our scale winemaking is very, very hands-on. Whole cluster fermentations are part of it. We are sorting every cluster and berry that comes through for center of effort. And then on the other side, we're making more commercial wines. And we're probably making pieces of wines that all of your audience has had or may have in their cellar right now. So it's kind of more part of the mid-size commercial winemaking of California, whereas we're very, very focused on a state.
A lot of wineries do bottling for other wineries. That's one of the mainstays of California, it seems like. Before I get into the wines and the other stuff, one of the things that really caught my eye when I was first contacted was your new certification. You are now SIP certified. Tell us what SIP certified is and how you come about being SIP certified and what it involves. And I mean, I just from what I read from it, it's like, oh, wow. But, you know, what I'll let you tell everything that goes into it.
Happy to. So SIP certification means sustainability in practice. And it grew out of the Central Coast Vineyard team, which is a group that started to meet in the early 90s in the Central Coast. And they started with tailgate meetings, just learning from each other, learning from other farmers how to improve practices. They eventually created a set of standards and a self-assessment system. And the idea was that every year.
Nathan.
I'm sorry? Yes.
Central Coast, what parameters are we speaking?
Well, I would say I'm not going to be maybe exactly right, but say Santa Barbara County north to the San Francisco Bay.
Oh, okay. So all the way up to San Francisco. Okay. I just wanted a rough parameter. Yeah,
it's a pretty big appellation, but the heart of it is really probably Monterey and Paso Robles and Santa Barbara County. Like that,
okay.
That is probably the bulk of it.
Sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to get a perimeter there. Yeah.
Yeah, perfect. We that group created the set of standards and a self-assessment system, and it was probably in about 2010 or 2009 that they came out with an actually audited program. And so now every year we are audited by a third party. They come in and look at how we have – largely it's how we keep records on our practices in the vineyard. And so there are sections that include – looking at what kind of measures we're taking culturally to prevent disease, whether we're farming under best practices and if we're farming at an economically sustainable level as well. So we generally are looking at what blocks are in decline and need to be removed or replanted. Are we growing varieties that make sense for the area? There's a big part of it that that looks at how we treat our community, our employees. And so it's interesting that there's a really human element, there's a environmental element, and there's a financial element as well. The new certification that we just attained. So we have had the SIP certification for all our farming operations since 2014. But the new certification is a winery certification program.
Now
it's looking at how we operate in production, how our energy and water resources are utilized and tracked. And so we are the first custom winemaking facility. So as we make wine for other businesses, we're the first custom winemaking business that has attained that certification.
Wow. Well, congratulations. That is quite a coup, it sounds. But I noticed it's the little paper says here that the rules called the standards require a measurable holistic set of practices addressing habitat, water, energy, soil, recycling, air quality, packaging, pest management, social equity, and business management. It's just like, it seems like that would be a full-time job just trying to address all those things there.
You know, you'd be surprised, but if you're running a you know, if it's a well-run business, you're thinking about most of those things anyway. And just putting metrics in place and goals in place, it really can help you to, I think it actually has helped me to get my team behind this. Like when we make this a mandate or a, you know, that this is a focus of the business, I have them come to me with really good ideas that we can implement too. And, you know, things we may not have thought of before. And so it's really helpful. I think it's helped us to get stronger and tighter and have a good focus.
Well, that would make sense. If everyone gets on board with it, then it would be a team effort and would make it easier for everyone involved. Okay. Is this organic? Is this biodynamic? Is this anything close to that? How does it fit into those two different practices?
Yeah, I would say that an audited sustainability program is more of a pragmatic, and it is, you certainly could be organic or biodynamic and still have a SIP certification as well. We do not carry an organic or a biodynamic certification. In our climate, we're very near the ocean. We're 4.5 miles from the coast and very foggy kind of growing climate. Organic is really difficult. And so we could farm organically, but it would require probably four or five times the application of milbicide that we do right now. It would use chemicals that are harder on the environment, my soil, and my employees. So we choose to use really targeted techniques and a lot of cultural techniques, opening up the canopy to let a lot of air circulation get to the clusters rather than just spraying sulfur every week.
Right. Yeah. And I noticed you were close to the coast, and I was thinking about mold, and it has to be a problem there, especially with Pinot Noir and their clusters and stuff. So I did notice, though, that you mentioned somewhere I read that you have, you know, animals in the vineyard, which sounds biodynamic, and some other things that you mentioned. That's why I was thinking, is this biodynamic? It sounds like some of the practices are right there.
Yeah, we're not. And I've actually made a bit of a study of biodynamics. I love to garden, and so I've used preps in gardening, and I've worked with a group at Cal Poly, California Polytechnic State University has kind of an experimental farm where they were doing quite a bit of prep making. So I'm interested, but I also trained as a scientist. I studied marine biology initially. And I think that there's probably a lot of things that have an effect, but maybe the biggest effect is that maybe biodynamics makes you listen a little bit closer to what's happening and spend a little bit more time understanding your site. And I think that we already do that, and we're trying to, you know, use methods that make sense. But certainly we are farming with cover crops that make sense for what we're trying to attain with the soil fertility. We are, we have an insectary block where we're actively, you know, promoting positive insects that can compete against the pest insects that we have. We're establishing a wildlife corridor right now to help kind of keep the deer that are predators of our property over on their side of
it. Yeah. Oh, a constant battle.
Yeah. The deer, the gophers, you know, we're all of these things. But we just actually finished painting the new owl boxes that we're putting up. We try to circulate, put a few new ones up every year. And this is about the time that the owls are going to be looking for a new nest site. So we're going to get those up this week. All those things are helpful, you know?
All right. Well, it, you know, like you say, biodynamic is just really understanding nature and the nature's impact on your vineyard, and you all seem to be doing that now anyway. So anything short of just having a certification saying you are now biodynamic, it sounds like you're almost there as far as the understanding of the correlation between nature and your vineyard and the people working it.
Yeah. We have neighbors that are farming biodynamically. They're making great wines.
They are popping up more and more. When we first started to talk about biodynamic on the program here, it was like, 8-9 years ago, and it was hard to find anyone that did biodynamic farming, and now they're popping up everywhere. It's exciting to see it happen, so. But no, the SIP certification, that again, congratulations on that. So let's talk a little bit about the winery. How many vineyards do you have? How many acres and of what?
Yeah, well, we have three sites. The original site is about a 100-acre parcel. It was originally planted in 1997 by the previous owners, and it has about 55 acres right now of Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, in about an equal split. And I really, really recently developed a small block of the upper part of the vineyard to Syrah. So we're planting a Syrah Noir clone from the Northern Rhone. That's what we call Center of Effort 1. About in 2015, we had acquired our neighbor's property, which is adjoining just upslope from our property. And, in this part of California, water is always a question. And the Edna Valley, it doesn't really have one big aquifer. It kind of has little pockets, right? And so we happen to have some really, really strong wells, whereas their property, they barely could, they really didn't have enough for much more than just landscaping. And so when we purchased the property, we kind of saw the potential of that site. It really is, it's kind of an extension of we have almost a kind of sand dune soil, like very, very lean and very good for red wine grapes. And so on that property, we developed Grenache and Syrah and Mourvèdre, so the classic kind of Southern Rhone varieties. And we plan to develop a red Rhone program there. First one's April, and we're moving in that direction with that part of the property.
So it's going
then
to be you're going to get away from just the Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, and you're going to expand out to the Rhone varieties. And that's cool.
Yeah. And our climate, we're the coolest climate growing region in California analytically, but I think more importantly, we're like the most moderate. So we have a very, very early bud break in the spring, maybe in late February. And we may harvest wash in, right up against Thanksgiving, depending on the year. And so we have this really long period of growth that will allow us to grow cool climate varieties like Pinot Noir, but we also can do really beautiful Syrah and Grenache, but in the right location. Not every location is suited for those later ripening wines.
Uh-huh. And then you have one other vineyard you were starting to tell me about.
We do. We have Bill Swanson, the winery owner, his mother, who, she was a little girl growing up on that vineyard in the Central Valley. She has a house about 3 miles away from the winery, I want to say. And when she moved into that place, she told Bill that she wanted to have a few grapevines. And so Bill gave me the task of planting a vineyard for his mother. And we looked at the site. It's really quite different than our site. And decided that it was going to have to be a white wine variety. And so we chose Chenin Blanc. And it's, I would say that this has become our most popular wine with our wine club members and visitors. It's delicate, beautiful, aromatic, and it produces well there. It's been really lovely to work with.
So, I like a Chenin Blanc too. It seems to be a grape that doesn't get enough recognition. The Chenin Blancs are sort of the ugly redheaded stepsister when it comes to white wines. And you don't
They're so versatile. You know, they're so versatile with food. They're, you know, traditional styles go from dry to off-dry to sweet wines or sparklers. So I think there was just a lot that we could do with that variety. And we knew that it would love the climate. Oh, my gosh, I'm looking out, and I just saw a coyote just went right across the vineyard. Hopefully he's eating some gophers.
Yeah, there you go. That's what they're there for. Eat the gophers. They will do that. that's cool. Before I forget it too, and I was thinking about this earlier. Are you affected any by the wildfires in California?
I hope not. We did have some days that were pretty smoky here, and we are running analysis as we're having our wines complete fermentation. But so far we look pretty good. We have had a few clients that have had wines that do appear, you know, to have some effect. And we have some other clients who've just canceled harvesting because clearly the fruit was not going to be useful.
Oh, that's so sad. That really is so sad.
It's so sad.
There was an article in the paper here just Sunday talking about some of the areas up there and how throughout California, mostly Sonoma, how so many vineyards they're just letting them go because they know that they are so, you know, the smoke has just gotten to them so badly that it's not going to do them any good to put the effort in to do it. And that just really, it's heartbreaking for me. I really do understand that. So, but you haven't been affected. That's good. I'm glad to hear that. And you're in a good spot too. You probably have the prevailing winds coming in, blowing the smoke toward the east. And so,
We did. We're south of the Big Sur area. So if you imagine San Luis Obispo is the closest city to us, about 5 miles away. And Dolan Fire burned about 130,000 acres, I believe, in the Big Sur wilderness. And that smoke kind of came right down the coast of the California. And there were a few days when it would just pop in and really choke our area. I think Paso Robles, which is just over the mountains, had a little bit worse air quality. That's where my house is. And so there were days that it was much worse on that side of things. But I don't know. I think that relative to a lot of friends who just had no vintage or, you know, 20% of what they usually would do, we kind of dodged a bullet here. But this is kind of going to be a factor, you know, it's as climate changes, as you know, forests we're surrounded by wilderness forest, will continue to be an issue that we deal with.
For a long time. I'm trying to put it in perspective. How far north are you of San Simeon Castle?
We are actually south of San Simeon. I bet it would take me about 1 hour to drive there, probably 45 miles up the coast.
Oh, to the castle. Okay, Hearst Castle. Okay. I was thinking you were north. Oh, okay. So that puts you even more in perspective for me. Okay.
I would tell people that we're halfway between Los Angeles and San Francisco and about halfway between Santa Barbara and Monterey.
Right in the middle of the coast there, you know, and close enough to the coast to get the influence there too. Oh, that's cool. Okay, so when are you looking at harvesting and making wines out of the new Rhone grapes that you are planting?
Well, we have the first little bits of, you know how a vineyard goes, like the first few years that you have a harvest, it's not really at full maturity.
Just let it grow,
Yeah, and so we made rosé primarily last year. The Syrah was only producing a small amount. This year we have a decent crop, and we will make some red wines, but we did have a heat spell that kind of scorched one side of the Syrah, and so we had just the, you know, raisins on one side and unripe fruit on the other side.
Oh, my
gosh. It's just like, what do you even do? So we actually sent a crew through, harvested the raisins. I'm fermenting them in barrels with the heads knocked out right now, and it's almost 40 bricks. Very, very sweet. So I think we have a dessert wine on our hands. And as the ferments have started, they just smell really exotic, like kind of chocolate and pipe tobacco and, you know, rich, ripe cherries. So I think we might have something really interesting. And meanwhile, we've picked now the rest of the fruit as it attained full ripeness. And those look like they're going to make really, really nice wines for us.
It sounds like your raisin wine there could be a good basis for a port.
I think that we're going to head that way. I have a friend in Bagnols in the south, you know, south of France, up against the Spanish border. And so I sent her an email, Elise, what do I do here? She gave some advice.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to have something interesting.
With that higher Brix and the raisin, that sounds, I mean, you know, I would be thinking port myself on that. We can't call it port, but, you know. Wow, that sounds it sounds like fun. You know, something there.
We're gonna learn something for sure.
Yeah, really. I mean, that port, or even a very sweet dessert wine, but you know, with the raisins, it sort of tints itself. And you mentioned the chocolate, and the you know, you're describing port to me there. So,
yeah.
But I've always liked a good port, so I'm a little bit biased when it comes to that. You make
in your I was going to ask, in your winemaking, have you made fortified wines in that style as well?
No, not in that style. I made a fortified wine with strawberries and grapes, and I made a strawberry port. It wasn't real heavy, but it was sweet, and it was made with, you know, Florida strawberries. Very big seller. I sold a lot of it. I could not make a port like you have the potential to there. So that's why I added strawberries and did strawberries with it and came out with something a little bit unique in itself. But
cool.
That's only effort I ever had, and it worked, and it worked well for me, so I stayed with that one and that one only. But I've always liked port, and because of the grapes and Florida climate and all sorts of stuff I can get into it, I could not make a classic port style. But the strawberry port was probably, well, many people said it was my signature wine. Yeah,
wow.
It was very, very good. Very, and Mike used to enjoy it too. It was one of his favorites. And so, but yes, I like ports. Your other wines, what you have currently, what you do now, you do Pinot Noir and Chardonnay.
That's been the focus of the winery from the start, mostly because, you know, it was an existing vineyard planted in 1997, so it was already, you know, it had 10 or 11 years of age by the time that that I came to it. And so Chardonnay is the signature grape of the Etna Valley Appellation. It just does really, really well here. On this property, we have a lot more kind of lean soils, almost what I would think of as red wine soils. They're a little bit limiting on canopy growth, and so our Chardonnay is spectacular, but it's very high in natural acid. You know, being so near the ocean, it protects natural acid, but in our case, it almost to a fault. So a lot of my winemaking is trying to build some richness and fullness onto the frame of the wine. And I love the acidity in white wines. That's really the skeleton of the wine. Like, that's what holds a wine together and gives it, you know, its longevity in the bottle. And so we've used a lot of special techniques. So we use really, really long surlies aging. We leave the wines without SO2 for a lot of the early part of their life and let the oxygen really, really work on the wine and develop it. We have, we've looked a lot at cooperage. So we use French oak, like as a majority of the cooperage, but also concrete vessels. So we're using the egg-shaped concrete vessels. And then acacia wood barrels. So a lot of diversity to try and build layers and complexity into the wine.
Do you transfer them from the different barrels, or do you just have one that's aged in the the concrete eggs, and one that's aged in the big ones, and one that's aged in oak, or do you transfer them around?
Well, the signature wine is called Center of Effort, and it's just our top estate wine. That's probably the most diverse. It uses a lot of those techniques. They're all brought together to make one kind of seamless wine. But then on top of that, probably our most popular white wine has been a Chardonnay called Giallo Solare, which means, I think it means like solar yellow, and it is entirely fermented in concrete vessels. And so what happens in the concrete acts much like a barrel in allowing a lot of oxygen to move into the wine and help to develop it. It acts like a barrel in having, you know, a good ratio of the lees or the sediments of the yeast in contact with the wine. And they give a lot of the flavor and texture back to the Chardonnay. And yet it leaves the fruit completely pure. So there's not any overlay of oak. And they're really beautiful wines. It shows like this white peach, the kind of tangerine citrus fruit character that we have in our Chardonnay here. And they're beautiful wines. I love that wine.
You don't oak a lot then?
We've gone further away from oak as the concrete has become a bigger part of our program. And on top of that, we're choosing coopers that are not very overt. So I want barrels that have a little bit more freshness and a little bit more maybe raw oak character and less of the toasty vanilla. With our wines are a little bit more kind of citrus and savory. And so I need barrels that will work with that and make for a wine that that shows itself and shows the property very clearly.
Well, good for you.
It's just totally different than our Pinot Noir barrel program, which does kind of go for more long toasting, smooth, sweet kind of mocha and cocoa tones. And that's what works in the Pinot Noir on this property.
Well, the Pinot Noir would, but I was saying good for you on the Chardonnay not over oaking it, because so often, especially if a wine is as acidic as you were saying this one comes in at, winemakers will throw oak in it to try to balance out that acid. And all it does is just give you oaky acid. And I'm glad you don't try to play with it. And you know what I mean. Yeah. And
I think there's enough winemakers doing that style of Chardonnay. And I think Chardonnay has become a really style-driven wine. I really want to take the approach of what's special about this place. And that's really the key here. When we have an estate project, what's the voice that the vineyard has, and sort of try to highlight that rather than enforce my will or idea of what it should be.
Yeah. And Chardonnays come in so many different styles. Now, do you do a malolactic on it or not?
Yeah, we do, but we try to choose. It's funny, we're all native yeast on most of our winemaking here, but for the malolactic, I choose a really selected, very clean strain because I want the acid reduction and the richness, but I don't want to influence the flavor too much.
Yeah, and you start getting too much of a malolactic fermentation on it, that just changes the Chardonnay completely. I remember people used to come into the winery and go, "Oh, I like a big buttery Chardonnay." I said, "Well, then you don't like Chardonnay. You like to have yourself a spoon of butter. You can buy that at grocery store." Yeah,
I think the biggest compliment is when someone says, "I don't usually like Chardonnay, but this is delicious." Like that's my favorite thing to hear.
And without doing a heavy malolactic and by letting it stay a little bit acidic, you are showing the Chardonnay as it should be shown, not creating something that isn't. And so, congrats to you on that. I think it's the best way to present a Chardonnay. The Pinot Noir. And we've talked to people before about Pinot Noirs, and we went into different clones and all that. You clone driven? Or do you have the ones that you have planted there are a specific clone and you just stayed with that style? I mean, the Pinot Noir seem to be a different breed.
Clones are definitely, important in Pinot Noir. And yet I don't think that I wouldn't say we're clonally driven. When I took over the estate here, we had three clones of Pinot Noir planted. They were clone 23 or Mariafeld, which is not It was brought to the U.S. as a sparkling wine clone, and it's a pretty loose cluster. It has the advantage of really drying out quickly in our climate. So if there's morning fog, as soon as the sunlight hits it, it kind of dries up the cluster. And so that's been really a strong kind of structure piece, but not a real aromatic variety. Then we have clone 115, which is one of the Dijon clones. And that's a pretty good all-around workhorse, a little bit more like classic, pretty little small pine cone-shaped Pinot Noir cluster, but it's pretty tight, and it can have problems with, you know, bunch rot in the middle, and it's a little bit more delicate, but it's really perfumed and kind of an all-rounder. And then there's one other clone here, clone 2A or Vadensville, and Vadensville is not really well-loved very many places other than when I worked in Oregon. I saw people loved it in certain situations there, and then here on the Central Coast, it was, I know it was the early chunk of like Gandecito and of Talley vineyards, like that was kind of an early building block for those vineyards. And so those were the three we had to start with. And as we've done redevelopment, we've looked at different clones and brought some different clones in, but maybe more so like rootstocks that are suited to the site, approaching the vine density. So we're going a lot denser in our planting. And changing row orientation as well.
Oh, that seems odd, and only because you say changing row orientation, it seems odd that you're so close to the coast and you will be getting a prevailing coastal wind in most of the time, and changing row orientation. And how's that going to affect the everything?
Yeah, well, in this valley, at the time that our original vineyards were planted, so in 97, the prevailing wisdom was like an 8-foot by 5-foot row spacing, which left room for the tractors of the day that were getting to be more narrow and powerful, and then and then running the rows north-south. And the problem with that is it gives you a fruit zone that has morning sun and a fruit zone that has afternoon sun. And when you go through and try to balance the light on the clusters, you get really different effects on morning and afternoon sun. And so in a lot of our new red wine plantings, we've taken the row direction. First thing, we've increased the number of vines. So we've gone down to a 6-foot row and a 3-foot spacing between the vines.
Wow.
So over double the number of vines per acre. The idea is we want to ask less of each vine. And so we're looking for very high quality, but not giving up a lot of the productivity of the vineyard. And point of reference, like Burgundy is 1 meter by 1 meter. So they almost have double the density yet of what we're doing in our densest vineyard.
Wow.
And then we're taking the row direction to 27 degrees. And what that does is when we do get these kind of heat storm events in the fall, it leaves the clusters in the shadow of their own canopy at the hottest time of day. And so that's been really key in just being protective and yet opening the fruit zone so that there's a lot of air circulation and drying that can happen there. So it's been really good for wine quality.
Yeah, that I can see. You know, that just surprised me. That's awful close centers you have on those plants. I didn't realize that, you know, Burgundy was that much closer. I always thought they were spaced a little bit more than that. The vineyard I had, it was, you know, 3-foot centers, and I almost thought about going a little bit wider, but it's so hot, I needed the air to flow through it, and the humidity and all that was bad. But
interesting. Well, that's your terroir. I think that we all have to kind of adapt to what our local condition is, and that's exactly what this is all about, learning that.
Yeah, And I like the approach, too, of doing some heavy pruning, and you're still getting your same harvest, but it's not putting as much effort into each of the vines to try to produce it all. So, yeah, that's a good idea. as if you need my blessing for that or anything. I noticed here that you have some 2015 Chardonnay, 16, 14 Pinot Noir, and a Magnum. 17 Chardonnay. What do you have out now? What is it, the 17 you have out now?
Yeah, I think that we're releasing, let's see, the top one, the center of effort, we'd like to hold it in the cellar for a little bit of time with the high natural acidity. The wine's just unwind a little bit slowly. The top wines are 20 months in élevage before we bottle. And so, you know, they've already had a little bit longer time than most Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. So we're rolling out 16 vintage right now with the effort, which is effort is sort of our second wine, kind of our everyday wines. Those are the 2017 vintage currently. And then we have a number of special bottlings that may be, I think we have some 2015 and 16 wines. There may be a 17 here and there as well. So it kind of depends on where the wine needs to release. And the Chenin Blanc, we're looking forward to the 2020 vintage wine next. So we're currently sold out, but we'll, yeah.
Young, get it out there. Yeah. Yeah. That's true. So so you're about, you know, 2 to 3 years behind on your wines, getting them out on the shelf from the vintage date, then it looks like.
Yeah, I mean, I have 2019 wines in right now in barrel that will be evaluated in January and bottled in April, and we wouldn't expect to release those for at least another year. So we'll be in through the 17 and the 18 wines before those hit the market.
Oh, okay, very good. You told me all about Chardonnay and the taste characters and all that, but then we started talking about the clones on the Pinot Noirs, and I didn't give you a chance to talk about the characteristics and all that of the Pinot Noir. How do you make your Pinot Noirs? What are the characteristics? What are you looking for?
Yeah, well, our estate, it's mostly an old sand dune that was laid down by the ocean long ago, and so you can imagine trying to grow anything in sand, it's you know, it's pretty limiting in terms of vigor. And so there's a lot of sunlight exposure and a lot of concentration in our fruit. So I would say, like, where our Chardonnay kind of comes off as, you know, Chablis acidity with California fruit, the Pinot Noir is pure California. You know, it's the Pinot really wants to be rich and kind of big, bold, dark in color, which is not always common for Pinot Noir. And so in Pinot Noir, a lot of it is, you know, going against just the straight fruit-driven wine. I am doing a lot of whole cluster fermentation, native yeast, and using oxygen to let the wine develop as well. But with the aim of having a balanced, you know, I want a wine that has fruit character and some oak as a part of the wine, but also herbal and savory kind of all in balance. So that's the mind's eye.
That sounds delicious for a Pinot Noir. I like a good Pinot Noir. Do you use just one vineyard for your Pinot Noir? I mean, like your 2017 effort Pinot Noir, is that a single vineyard vintage, or do you do any blending from others?
Well, no, it's all estate. So we grow it all on this property. And, you know, I think you could look at our estate and we break it into blocks. So we have 7 different blocks of Pinot Noir. However, we break it down further into sub-blocks and really farm on a vine-by-vine basis. So when it comes time to harvest, I'll have as many as probably 25 to 35 individual fermentation lots of Pinot Noir that are from different picks or different sections of each vineyard. There's sections where we have like a Pinot Noir planted on a slope that has very shaley kind of rocky soil on the top and then pretty rich loamy stuff down on the shoulders. And it may roll over from like a morning facing slope on one side to an afternoon facing slope on the other. And so we've split that up into as many as like 6 different harvests over the course of 2 weeks. And, and so we kind of just really attend to what, you know, we're harvesting about maybe 4 tons of Pinot Noir in a normal harvest night. And that's about what my crew in the winery can manage to sort and process. And we would ferment in roughly 1.5 ton fermentation lots. So we end up with a lot of complexity and a lot of pieces of the puzzle that we then are able to put back together you know, much later in the life of the wine.
Oh, okay. So you basically keep them separate up to the end till you get the flavor profile that you're looking for, that you are trying to achieve on each one.
Yeah, I mean, I think of our like our blending process, it starts out pretty subtractive. So like we'll start to do triage tasting early next year of the new wines. And as things just aren't working, they won't progress in our top program. And then as we get to the end of next summer, we'll select the top wines that we want to hold for making the center of effort bottling. We'll put those into the cold cellar and hold it over winter. And then in January, we'll come back. And this is when we start like the additive process where we choose what's going to be the core part of the blend. And then we look at the pieces that can add some nuance and some, you know, layers to that blend. And we'll get to what the final wine will be. And so it's a long process, and we get to know the wines really, really well by the time we get all the way to the end.
Oh, you have to. You can't just expect to one to be the same year after year. I mean, when you start to evaluate them, do you keep some of them that aren't oaked? Or do you oak all of your Pinot Noirs? I'm just looking at something here. Do you keep anything that is un-oaked for blending purposes, or do you just flat out oak everything?
We generally go to French oak for everything, but
okay.
A lot of that will be neutral or older barrels. We have recently started to experiment with holding Pinot Noir in concrete vessels as well. And
uh-huh.
So we had just our first full year of watching that. It was really interesting. Like the wine was quite different in how it progressed in the concrete. And I think that we saw kind of a greater aromatic range in concrete than we did in the same wine in barrel. So
no,
I think
imagine.
We learned a little bit. We'll incorporate that eventually.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, a nice approach to Pinot Noir, something a little bit more aromatic as opposed to the oak. You know, not that
yeah.
I'm not a fan of oak, but it's just, you know, sometimes I think oak is overused in different wines, and so I hate to see it destroy a good fruity wine by oaking it because the book says that wine is supposed to be oaked, you know, and it just drives me crazy. So,
yeah. Yeah, I can agree with that, sure.
Yeah. this is, you know, the way I go. Mike, do you have any questions, anything for Nathan here? Anything that you've observed you want to ask him while we were going through this?
No, I'm good so far. I've just been taking the usual notes, so... Yeah, everything's good. Thank you.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Nathan, you're in the Edna Valley AVA, right?
We are.
Okay. And which is part of California. And is that within the Central Coast AVA also?
Yeah, it is. You can think of... if you're traveling up the California coast, say if you're leaving Los Angeles, you're going to go through Santa Barbara wine country. So that would be Santa Rita Hills and San Ynez Valley, Santa Maria Valley. And after you cross the Santa Maria Valley, the Santa Maria River, you'll enter San Luis Obispo County. And Edna Valley is just basically just kind of tucked in from the ocean right by the city of San Luis Obispo, which opens out at Morro Bay. And then if you go up over the coastal mountains, just 20 miles, you're in the Paso Robles Appalachian, which is known for very big, rich, you know, heavy reds. So we have like this in our region, we have kind of the best of this coastal, really aromatic, you know, lighter style wines. And then you have really rich, full red wines just over the hill.
Yeah, you know, Paso Robles. We've talked to a couple of wineries, Paso Robles, recently, and they're big reds and big Pinot Noirs and stuff like that. They have the heat and they, you know, play it to the max on it when they do those. Is there any other wineries right around in the Edna Valley AVA, or are you the only one?
Oh no, there's probably 20 wineries here. Historically, like Edna Valley Vineyards was the most known, you know, winery in this valley. It was a partnership between the Niven family who planted the Paragon Vineyard and then the Chalon winery, a really famous Pinot Noir producer. And so that kind of was one of the early anchors of our valley. It kind of got a lot of renown and sort of drove the planting of a lot of Chardonnay here. And then also Chamisal Vineyards was an early player, and they still make beautiful wines. But also, like Alban Vineyards, one of the most renowned of the Rhone, the early kind of Rhone proponents in the area, they're located really near us as well. So, yeah, there are 20-ish wineries here in this valley, and a lot of other wineries further afield use some grapes for their wines as well.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize how many. I lived in California a number of years ago. I used to go up and down the coast and be in the wineries and, you know, Paso Robles and different areas. And the valley, I think, had two wineries when I was out there in the early mid-70s. And Paso Robles had like maybe a half a dozen. And it was just last time I was out there, you know, a few years ago, it was just like, oh, my gosh, look at this. I just like everywhere there was wineries. And that surprised me when you said there's so many of them there in Edna Valley, because I only remember two or three of them when I was there in the mid-70s. So, everything grows up. Give me information on membership to your club. Give me how to contact you, Facebook, emails, phone numbers, how to get a hold of Center of Effort Winery and Wines, just all the stuff so that the listeners out there can add Center of Effort Wine and your new SIP certification wines onto their list of wines to purchase. Give me all the stuff you can.
For sure. It's fairly easy because almost all of our social media and our website address is just COE Wine. So coewine.com will take you to our website. I think at coewine will show you Instagram or Facebook. And it's a great time to kind of look at what we've been doing, maybe at our Facebook page or on Instagram, because my team has built a whole series of videos. So it's a little video series we've been releasing every Friday called Harvest Up Close, and it takes you through all the steps of harvest, like a lot of the decisions that we make from night harvesting out in the vineyard, you know, the way that we do our fermentations in Pinot Noir. I know that we're going to have a Chardonnay video coming up pretty soon that'll show the concrete eggs and the fermentation inside. So we've had a lot of fun doing this. And I think it's, you know, especially during this time when it's hard to kind of travel anywhere, you know, very far afield, you can kind of just see what's happening here in wine country and what, you know, the thought and craft that goes into what we do.
Is those archived so people can go back and check the old ones?
Yeah, they are. They're on our, I think they're on a Vimeo page or something like this. I'm not
press,
the most
press
savvy on that. But yeah.
Press and media. That's the page they're on. Do you have a blog or anything like that that anyone puts out of there?
We haven't done that. I'd love to. I'd love to write, but I just find that it's really hard to commit to it, you know, on a regular basis. I think it's something that maybe we're doing a video version of that right now, and hopefully we'll keep that going. There's certainly a lot of topics to address. And we are going to, as we're developing our insectary, we are planning to have either an Instagram page or a website so that people can kind of see pictures of the plants that we're planting. They can see the beneficial insects that we're hosting there. And, you know, hopefully we'll have some families of owls that move into our owl boxes. So the intent would be that we're going to kind of showcase a lot of our sustainability actions and I think that people don't realize just how much nature and how much interconnectedness there is in a vineyard. And it's even good for us just to take the time to notice it and show it to people as well.
As a case in point, oh, wow, there's a coyote running across the vineyard.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. There's a good example. So, it's great. And, you know, I've looked at some of your media things, your little videoettes, if you will, and they're great. So anyone out there, you know, by all means, check those out. And Center of Effort Winery, they are located in Central Valley, California. Well, not Central Valley, the Central Coast in California. And they just got a new SIP certification, which, again, congratulations on that. That seems like an effort that is well worth the time, and it's going to reap you rewards on that without question, because it's going to end up creating better wines. I'm sure it will. So, Nathan, thank you for taking your time to join us tonight, and good luck on finishing your harvest and your next vintage. And if anyone wants to get a hold of you, they have a membership club too, which it's on their webpage. Yeah, you can,
you'll find it there. I think it's coewine.com and a /join, and that should get you there.
Yeah, and so you can become members. Wines are reasonably priced. You're not going to be spending, you know, hundreds of dollars for a bottle. They are reasonably priced, especially the lower tier ones that he was talking about. And you can get, you know, the ones a little bit more expensive, and you're paying for quality. Keep that in mind too. So, you know, you got the quality. But Nathan, again, thank you very much for the time that you took tonight to join us, and very interesting and informative. I enjoyed the conversation. I was looking forward to it, and it was not disappointing. So take care of yourself.
Thank you very much.
And
Mike, thanks very much.
No, you're quite welcome. And if we're ever out in that area, we will definitely be stopping by and visiting you.
And you'll be welcomed. Yeah, love to see you.
Great. Thank you very much. Have a good evening now.
All right. Good night, guys.
Bye now. And Nathan is gone.
Yeah.
That was fun. It was interesting. You know, he bringing up some points there, you know, about growing in the Central or in the Central Coast I didn't know about, and a little bit different orientations on the vineyards and stuff like that. That was interesting. And that SIP certification, oh my gosh, I mean,
very involved.
Yeah, very involved. First one that we've heard about, the first time we've heard about the SIP certification. And so that's something to keep an eye on, see if we see anybody else out there. So again, Nathan, thank you for your time tonight, and we really do appreciate it. Next week, we have our Halloween show. We'll be talking about haunted wineries and haunted, well, Joy Neighbors is our guest, and she works at a brewery now, I think, or a bourbon factory or something. I'm not sure what she said. I can't remember right offhand, but she said that is also haunted. So, you know, it's all about wine, but we'll be talking about ghosts and places that are haunted and all that. And whether you believe it or not, I'll tell you what, there's a lot of places in this country that are haunted. We'll be mentioning some of them and all that next week.
Oh, yeah. So
tune in, and then we got guests coming up in November. I also want to give you a tease here. I found a very good article on Pinot Noir clones. And it talks about the different types of clones and where they come from and all that. And the next show, we don't have a guest, which I think is going to be the first Thursday in November. I don't think we have a guest that show. Maybe we do. I don't know. But first show, we don't have a guest. I'll talk about that, the Pinot Noir clones, because it's interesting, really, really interesting about all the clones and how they come about and why they are and all that. So that's something to come up. But next week, Joy's going to be joining us, and we're looking forward to that. She's always a good conversation and always a good guest. And so she'll be on next week.
Yeah, looking forward to that. We've always talked about cemeteries and some of the places that she's been to, we'll hear some updates, I'm sure, because it has been a while. So that'll be good.
Almost 3 years? I think it's been three years since he's been on.
Wow.
We'll look that up, check and see, but I think it's been 3 years, because I think it's been a couple of years now. We've just slid right through October and didn't do our haunted shows, and so.
Yeah. So. The anniversary from this year, I think we forgot that, or it was late or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
What happened then, but.
I don't know. So, yeah, really, it happens. And I do have to point out also that I made it to the whole show without Blog Talk Radio cut me out. So,
not have to. Next week will be totally different.
Yeah, probably will. But it was always good to get through one show without being cut off by Blog Talk Radio on there.
That was fantastic. I just realized when you said it, I go, oh, my gosh, you didn't disconnect or anything.
Yeah, I was on the whole show.
Good.
That's it. And
we will see you all next Thursday, October the 29th. And thank you all for tuning in. Have a great week. Be safe and enjoy it. Thank you to Nathan Carlson. And it was very enjoyable. We'll see you all. Thank
you. Yes, we do. Thank you. Be safe.
This concludes tonight's broadcast of All About Wine with your host, Ron. For show information, link to All About Wine on Twitter and Facebook, or to be a guest on the show, visit the show website at www.allaboutwinebtr.com. Archive shows are available for download on iTunes or on our show page at blogtalkradio.com/allaboutwine. Thank you for listening. Drink responsibly, and we'll see you next time on All About Wine.